Okay, we're going to start the next session, and I would like to introduce Janice West, who's an independent curator, and you can read all the biographical details in the literature. Janice West, independent curator.
On the hearing side, I just want to test that you can hear me at the back, as is traditional. Thank you very much. I'd like to start with a very short film from YouTube. It's of an automata created by somebody called John Joseph Merlin in 1773. Let's show it to you before I say any more. That's the Silver Swan, a life-size Silver Swan automaton at the Bose Museum in County Durham. I've seen this swan perform, as it were, many times, and it never fails to elicit gasps of delight, smiles, and applause from the audience. But what exactly are they applauding? There's no one there. It's not a sentient being. It's an automaton, rather. And that's the theme of my talk today. I got the title Serious Toys from a novel by Lawrence Durrell, and I'll read you the quotation it comes from. But did Aphrodite eat and excrete? I'm not enough of a classical scholar to quibble about it. After all, these are only serious toys, Felix. Serious toys. Lawrence Durrell's novel, Nunquam. The toy referred to is very serious indeed for the speaker, because she, and it is a she, is the object of desire, but is also his nemesis. She brings him down. She kills him at the end of the story. Revenge has become part of the information stored inside her. In Freud's 1919 essay, The Uncanny, he notes that the uncanny effect produced by waxwork figures, ingeniously constructed dolls and automata are the primary, in some ways, it's the first example he gives, cause of the uncanny, which of course is always a very subjective response. And he discusses the paradoxical feelings that they produce in the viewer. The contradictions of an object that appears to be alive and autonomous, but is created and controlled by man, and often built for human enjoyment. This notion is still acutely pertinent in a world where artificial intelligence departments of universities are working on the ideal cyberhuman. And the conflicted desires that these creatures brought and bring are freighted with fear and anxiety, as well as pleasure. And I'll discuss examples in this paper from John Joseph Merlin, whose swan we just saw, Via by Burne-Jones and Blade Runner, to the latest notions in artificial intelligence and automata. Very, very briefly, obviously, by no means an exhaustive story. As Freud at his desk. Each day, Freud apparently greeted the little bronze statue of a Chinese monk or sage from the Ming Dynasty or China. It was, in a sense, his familiar. Now, whether we think that these objects that he collected helped him in his work or were a mere distraction from his work, I'm not in a position to say, but it's something he valued. And certainly something that he referred to again and again, sometimes in his work with patients, such as the author H.D., Hilda Doolittle, and she often said in her writings that Freud talked more to the objects in the room than he did to her. Freud's example in The Uncanny is a story of the Sandman by Hoffman, but which is translated really into the ballet by Deneve Coppelia, and the doll Coppelia is also the Olympia, comes from the Olympia doll in the story. And the watchful stillness exhibited by the doll when she's being looked at is one of the most uncanny things about it. Here she's performed by the ballerina Emma Maguire, and you can see her eyes are watching us. They're watching what's going on. They appear to be unfocused, but they're not. They're always watchful. And indeed, in the ballet, when she's not being watched, she moves. So there's that kind of interplay. And I found the same sort of watchfulness, this fear and temerity, but also this intelligence in Christy Brown's work, The Sleepover. She discussed it in more this morning. We hadn't discussed it between us before today, so what she said was a pleasant surprise, because she could have said something completely different. And the Sandman story is particularly gruesome and unappealing because of this attack, or possible attack, on the eyes on Nathaniel, one of the characters in the story. Sculpture itself, as Bryony Fur says in her essay Sleep in Sculpture, must have an uncanny presence because of the special demands it makes on the spectator. This is not only a question of the actual circuits which the spectator walks around a sculpture or near a sculpture, but also of the imaginative circuits and fantasies he or she projects upon the still inanimate object. And I think that's very true in this case. Classical mythology has provided us with various examples of the desire to create by unnatural means. Prometheus created man with clay and also stole the gift of fire for humans to use, thus incurring the wrath of Zeus. I've got a short sequence now of paintings by Burne Jones, the Pygmalion sequence. And Pygmalion, was, according to Ovid, was a king of Cyprus who had an ivory statuette of a woman made because no real woman was good enough for him. So in this first of the sequence, you can see on the far side, real women, which he's ignored. He's ignoring in favour of the three graces, the three beauties, goddesses that Paris had to make his choice from on the other side. So here's the next one. Then he creates the sculpture, or has the sculpture created, and this is Burne Jones' title, The Hand Refrains, he refrains from touching it as he falls in love with it. But he appeals to Aphrodite, the goddess of love, and she rather obligingly transforms the statue into a beautiful woman, Galatea, whom he then worships. This is an unusual example in that terrible things don't happen to Pygmalion. You know, vengeance is not, it doesn't come to him because he appeals to the gods. So although this is, if you like, the mythological idea of unnatural creation, nevertheless, God is involved. Therefore, there's no hubris. Now, when you think of automata, or you think of unnaturally produced creatures, many people's first notion is Frankenstein's monster. And this is the monster played by Boris Karloff from James Whale's film of 1931. Unfortunately, the monster is often referred to as Frankenstein. This is an example where the creator and the created have become conflated into one being. And I think monster is quite a good term for it, because the word monster comes from the word same root as to demonstrate, to show. But when you reread Mary Shelley's novel of 1818, The monster was never supposed to be ugly. Victor Frankenstein built him as a creature to love, and a creature that was supposed to be better than human rather than worse than human, and certainly not a threat to human. In fact, the change into something less than human, more disturbing, happens when electricity, when the power hits his body. And I'll read a little bit from the novel. "How can I describe my emotions at this catastrophe, or how delineate the wretch with whom such infinite pains and care I had endeavoured to form? His limbs were in proportion, and I had selected his features as beautiful. Beautiful! Great God! His yellow skin scarcely covered the work of muscles and arteries beneath. His hair was of a lustrous black and flowing, his teeth of a pearly whiteness. But these luxuriances only formed a more horrid contrast with his watery eyes, that seemed almost of the same colour as the dun-white sockets in which they set, his shrivelled complexion and his straight black lips." The monster was also supposed to be educated, had a liberal education, but so that, as I said, he was supposed to be a finer human being than generally supposed. So perhaps, and this painting was made by Amelia Curran the same time that Mary Shelley was writing a book, we should see the monster as looking like Percy Bysshe Shelley, her husband, rather than like Boris Karloff. As I said, his liberal education meant that he was supposed to be an example to the world, but unfortunately, as we know, it didn't work out. And the monster regrets that this hasn't happened. "Elsewhere I see bliss, from which I alone and are irrevocably excluded. I was beautiful and good. Misery made me a fiend. Make me happy, and I again shall be virtuous." We can only, when we read the novel, have empathy with the monster. And of course, in James Whale's reading of the story, he inverts what Mary Shelley says. She blames the monster's decline into horribleness, if you like, into an object of fear and terror, on an unreceptive world and the things that went wrong in his creation. But James Whale blames the fact that he was given an abnormal brain by mistake. So his nature rather than his nurture. And this hubris and tragedy are the usual fate of creators of automata, in fiction at least. The tragedy of Frankenstein and the danger that such creatures could have for the human race inspired Isaac Asimov to formulate his three rules of robotics to guide the creation of artificial intelligence. And number one is, a robot may not injure a human being, or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. Of course, nobody's actually told the automata, the robots, that. So that's the sort of beginning of my story, but I'd like to look at some of the waxwork, some of the creatures that were created purely for pleasure. The following passage is from the Goncourt brothers' journal, describing dolls or automata designed for sexual pleasure as related to them by their joint mistress, Maria. "There exists, this is a fact, she has seen one herself, taken along by another midwife, there exist imitation women, complete in every detail, with all the charms and uses of a real woman, mannequins with flesh which you can push in and which comes out again, a tongue which darts in and out for 5 minutes, eyes which roll, hair which you would swear was the real thing, and moistness and warmth where you would expect to find them. This one was for a ship, but there are others to suit all pockets, down to male and female parts, in gilded boxes which cost only 300 francs. The artist who makes these things, this public benefactor, this moralist, endeavouring to avoid with so many evils, to spare men, for example, apart from anything else, that tempestuous age of women, that unbearable period, the change of life. This rare artist was prosecuted 6 months ago, no doubt on a charge of immorality. The Goncourt brothers' most satisfactory emotional relationship was with each other, and their writings are often casually misogynist, and here the focus is sexual and has fascination with the woman's body, but not real women, kind of body without risk. It's a clear indication that real women may pose a danger. But perhaps this is the kind of thing that they actually had in mind. Life-size and anatomically correct models were made to instruct medical students from the late Renaissance onwards. And probably the most famous is this one, the anatomical Venus, created in 1782 by Clement Sozzuoli. It's in Florence. And as you can see, it is, well, it's the size and dimensions of a real woman. Her stomach part can be taken off to reveal the anatomy within. There are male models in the same exhibition at La Specula, but the males are always kind of bits of body. They're not the whole body. They're not whole objects of desire. They do seem to have a more medical story behind them, while this one is kind of on the borderline, I suppose, between erotica and medicine. And this is a later 19th century anatomical Venus. Yes. La Specula, sorry, not from La Specula, from Montpellier. Like the anatomical Venus from Florence, it does have real hair, however, there are two here. This is very much part of the Enlightenment project, the humanist project of exploring man and exploring the world, and like post-Reformation way of thinking. I'd like to move back to Walter Martin now. Together with, if you like, the medical and the scientific automata, you do get tricks. This is Van Klemperen's hoax, the chest pair automata. So it's controlled very clearly from a body inside. There are many, many versions of this. And it's parallel to, and this technical innovation was parallel to a kind of political humanism, which I'll talk about a bit more. But the more rational the world was, the more people seemed to crave things that could not be easily explained away, things that were fantastic. Jacques Vaucanson was one of the most important automata making. Apparently created a life-size flute player and a life-size drummer who could play faster than any human being. Unfortunately, these have completely disappeared. We do have this photograph of the digesting duck or the defecating duck, and it seems strange to go to all this trouble to create something that apparently just defecated. And in Grenoble there is still a second version of it. Better known perhaps are the automata of Jacques Droz, which is a family, Jacques Droz is the surname. And this is the writer, the musician, and the draftsman from 1774. The faces, particularly of the small boys, the writer and the draftsman, have become kind of standard doll faces that we see in the 19th century. And they still do work, and there are several versions of them around the world. And in fact, Jacques Droz, as a company, still continues. They make watches, but on their website, they does say that if you want an automata made, they can make one to your specification. So if any of you were thinking of going down that route, they're the perfect people to see. There's also Maladay's drawing automata from 1800, a little later. This is now in the Franklin Institute, stripped of its clothes so that you can see the mechanism within. And he can draw and write seven different pieces. For me, the most poignant of which is this ship, because it kind of speaks to us of sailing away, of some kind of journey, this journey that this poor automata will never make. Now, I started off by talking about Merlin very, very briefly, and here's a portrait by Gainsborough. You can see it at Kenwood, and they have the gouty chair, which is an early wheelchair at Kenwood. and they had a very interesting exhibition in 1986, which really had a lot of research behind it. So items that had been ascribed to other automata makers were finally given to Merlin, as it should have been. Merlin was a very interesting man. He'd probably touched all our lives as children, in that he was the inventor of roller skates. So blame him. And here is the swan again. It's a life-size swan, it's glass, and as you can see, swims on a stream of twisted crystal. There are many YouTube videos, and they show the swan in much greater close-up than I could in the original video that I showed you. Joseph, Maya Day, and Jacques Droz all came from France or the Netherlands or Switzerland, but they all worked in London. And London was the prime, in the 18th century, the prime centre for automata selling and automata exhibitions. And you sometimes see this swan ascribed to James Cox. James Cox was a retailer, so his name was on the objects, but he didn't actually make them. And he had an office in Canton, in China, and China and Russia were the main markets for these other automata, although this one only went to England and France, as far as I know. This was first was shown in France, although it was made in 1773, at the 1861 exhibition, where it was seen by Mark Twain, the American novelist who wrote, "I watched the silver swan, which had a living grace about his movement and a living intelligence in his eyes. I watched him swimming around as comfortably and as unconcernedly as if he had been born in a morass instead of a jeweler's shop. I watched him seize a silver fish from under the water and hold up his head and go through the customary and elaborate motions of swallowing it." The original movement of this piece included him rising out of the water and moving his wings up, not actually flying, but almost, and then settling down, and then fishing. It was refurbished completely in 2008, and now it only has a minute's movement, which is a sad loss, but still really wonderful. It was bought by John and Josephine Bowes, for whom the Bowes Museum is named, and they created the whole project in 1872. They bought it for £200. But for them, this was a very unusual addition to their collection. They, like Mark Twain, had seen it first in 1861 at the Paris Exhibition, and they bought it specifically themselves in 1872. Unlike Freud, who carefully chose every element for his collection, they bought job lots. They would buy the tea towels that things were wrapped in and keep them. It was interesting listening to Esther's description of clutter. The Bowes Museum itself, although it started in 1867, was not opened until 1892 because it took so long to sort out the clutter, to sort out the mess. They had agents, the Bowes family had agents all over the continent, and they would just send them boxes of stuff. In those boxes of stuff are some wonderful things. There are Goya's and Velasquez, great paintings, great ceramics, but there's also a huge amount of what we could consider sort of hoarded matter, I suppose. The current television programs where you see people gathering things and objects to replace the great voids in their life are very much the way that the Bowes collected. This work was not seen by Charles Babbage, but Charles Babbage, who we consider the inventor of the computer, visited Merlin's workshop at the age of 9 in 1799. His workshop was in Princes Street of Hanover Square. And Charles was so interested in mechanical objects that Merlin took him upstairs to see the automata he was working on. They were female silver nudes about 1 foot high. And Babbage wrote, "One of these walked, or rather glided, about a space of about 4 feet, where she turned round and went back to her original place. She used an eyeglass occasionally and bowed frequently, as if recognising her acquaintances. The motions of her limbs were singularly graceful. The other silver figure was an admirable danseuse, a dancer, with a bird on her forefinger of her right hand, which wagged its tail, flapped its wing, and opened its beak. Now, Merlin died in 1803, and his stock was taken over by Weeks Mechanical Museum. The stock of the contents of which were auctioned in 1834, where Babbage bought one of the dancing ladies and exhibited her next to his difference engine. He noted that whereas his foreign visitors were fascinated by the difference engine, the early computer, all his British visitors wanted to look at the dancing lady. Not sure quite what that's like. There is one other large automata by Merlin in existence, and this is the Peacock Clock in the Hermitage Museum. This is only wound up once a year, though, so it's a very special occasion, and has three moving birds on it. So there was a sort of a feeling that inexorably, automata and technical innovation in the 19th century are put together. Joseph Faber's Euphonia, like in Martinville, he was working on prototype sound recording equipment, but he felt he had to express the sound coming out of the equipment, not in an anonymous way, but through the voice of a person, and that is Euphonia here. We go back to the wax mannequins here. The uneerie lifelikeness of the wax mannequins has stayed with us. And this is a fashion mannequin from the beginning of the 20th century, an American one. But anybody who's seen the 2006 Channel 5 programme, Guys and Dolls, which was about men who collect life-size and lifelike models, will know that this kind of preoccupation with the doll, the mannequin, is not just about fashion and display and spectacle, but it answers a kind of personal need. Moving up to present day a bit more quickly, many of us will have seen Oscar Pistorius running in the Olympics, where he uses running blades to replace the lower part of his leg. Prosthetics have entered into many, many lives, and we see them very much as positive. In this case, make him seem almost superhuman, since he can run faster with these blades than people can on their own legs. And also buy you the body that you want. Jeffrey Deitch, in his book Posthuman, written in the 1990s, posited the idea that in the future it was only people who could alter their bodies, who could, as it were, absorb technology into themselves, who would really be successful. And I was surprised, really, to, in the recent Wellcome Collection exhibition, Superhuman, where John Harris, who's a professor of bioethics, said, "I think many people have a horror of playing God," which has been the traditional view of the creation of automata. "But I think in the future it is inevitable that we will either be enhanced or that we will die out." His enhancement, the enhancement he was talking about, obviously was medical and psychological, not the cosmetic one here. So we do see these prosthetics as being inevitable and useful for the human race. This man has a hand so sensitive that he can type, he can use a computer using it, and it's actually motored, as it were, from his own nerve cells. One of the things that came to my notice only last Thursday, it was in the newspapers, was the creation of, I'm not sure, bioinformatics, which means that digital files, films, music, databases, etc., can be stored in DNA as part of our being, if you like. As the website for the European Biomatics Institute puts it, the science of bioinformation, or computational biology is increasingly being used to improve life as we know it. Well, not sure about that, but this idea that no longer is the automata the other, but it's become the self. I'd like to finish by quickly looking at the idea of the doppelganger, something that Freud also included as part of his uncanny. Doppelganger is where they, in this case, how they met themselves. So it's Rossetti and his wife meeting themselves, in fact, just before Rossetti's wife died. And it's the idea that the body and the soul become disconnected. And there's a sense of deja vu also connected with this idea. But some, including Professor Hiroshi Ishiguro, think this is a good thing. This is Geminoid, which is a remote-controlled doppelganger, designed and modelled after himself, obviously. And he says, one of the purposes for creating Geminoid is to explore the idea of tele-existence, to copy a natural human's presence so that she or he may exist in two places at once. And I quote from him, "I wonder how possible it is to separate one's inner self and outer self, to create distance between one's body and soul." That's exactly what the dread of the doppelganger is about. But it made me think much more of Narcissus. Now, apparently, he only uses this to scare his students at the moment, you know. But who knows what the future may bring. It makes me think the model for the 21st century version of Automata should perhaps be Narcissus rather than Prometheus. Thank you. Does anyone have any
questions? Thank you very much, Janice. Yes, thank you. I don't know about uncanny. I think that was quite disturbing in part, but maybe that's
but
my
personal...
But the
uncanny is disturbing.
Yes. Are there any questions from the floor? Good, I'll ask one then. Is this fascination with automata, I'm not sure, I'm completely confused on how to pronounce it, but is this fascination with automata an attempt to understand the body, do you think? Could one equate it to almost this idea of perverse antiquities, kind of digging, you know, archaeology, digging to unlock what we are?
Yes, but it's a projection of what we are as much as anything. Yeah. Different people have used it in different ways, have used them in different ways and created them for different reasons. Obviously from the Renaissance onwards there was that apparently scientific interest. The people in America who are doing research on much older automata, my fault for confusing you over the pronunciation. But we can only ever discover things about ourselves and about our thinking through this kind of research, through this kind of creation. Although, of course, we may not be discovering things that we really are comfortable about knowing, I think. And I think that's probably what I want to show. I did want to show you, in a sense, my paper fell into two parts, kind of imaginary and the real, and I did want to show just how impressive what remains of us of the real automata can be.
Thank you. Any further questions? Yes?
Hello. In Mike Kelly's exhibition on the uncanny, he purposefully excluded sort of miniatures and smaller objects. And I was wondering if, and he says that's due to like being able to project onto it, whereas more life-size and bigger objects maintain their physical presence. But I think Christy Brown's sleepover, as you mentioned, is quite a good example of like the smaller uncanny objects. Mm. Do you think the projection or the ability to be able to project into smaller objects gets in the way of it producing an uncanny feeling, or does that help aid it?
The uncanny is always a subjective response. I don't think, you know, what's uncanny for one person may not be uncanny for others. Christie's pieces, I think, because they are child's size, are even more uncanny in a way than they would be if they were adults. That's a personal feeling, but they're very eerie. Yes, I thought that choice of Mike Nelson's was an interesting one, because for many people, dolls and smaller pieces do seem to be the more uncanny objects. But I can't really comment on his choices. That's just my feeling about it. And certainly more fiction has been written about dolls coming to life than they have about life-size automata and uncanny. Automata and wax dolls.
Thank you very much, Janice. That's wonderful.